Welcome to episode 116 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Michael Lucas-Smith, and our guest this week, John Hylands. He's here to talk about his underwater robotics project, MicroSeeker, and his land-based MicroRaptor and other projects that he's been working on more recently. All of these are Smalltalk-powered and Smalltalk-driven. If you have feedback on this week's podcast or any podcast, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com, or head on over to Facebook, the Industry Misinterpretations group, the Smalltalkers group in Ning, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and please head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for us. So this is James Robertson, Syncom Smalltalk Product Evangelist. I'm here with Michael Lucas-Smith, our lead on the Web Velocity project.
G'day.
We've also got John Hylands, who's working on various robotic projects in Smalltalk. So John, why don't we get started by asking you where all this work came from? How long have you been working on robotics in Smalltalk?
Well, I started getting into the Smalltalk world back in 1987 at Carleton University. When I hit second year, I had three professors there, Wilf Lalonde, John Pugh, and Paul White, as well as Thomas. Thomas,
so
yes.
So you're part of the Ottawa Mafia then?
Yeah, I am part of the Ottawa Mafia. That's correct. So yeah, I started playing around with Smalltalk then and basically never stopped. Did a lot of work with the object people for any number of years, and back in about 1997, I was down in California working at Interval Research, and also in Smalltalk, of course, and I decided to, I started thinking about what I wanted to do in the future, in terms of, you know, careers and that sort of thing, and I've always been sort of interested in underwater stuff, building submarines and that sort of thing, you know, the kind that people go in. And, of course, always interested in programming, and I've always been building things since I was a little kid. So it seemed kind of obvious to mix the underwater and robotics things, and came up with building autonomous underwater vehicles. And, you know, autonomous underwater vehicles are basically robot submarines. They have to be pretty smart as far as robots go, because when the robots are underwater, they're pretty much on their own. You don't get a lot of overview with them. So it was pretty clear that I had to have a reasonable amount of processing power in this robot, and given that I was going to have a decent computer in it, of course I was going to run Smalltalk. You know, I've been using Smalltalk for 10 years at that point and was soundly hooked. So thus began my first Smalltalk robotics project, which was called MicroSeeker.
Well, you know, this is pretty big business now. There are robots putting down cable across the oceans, robots trying to detect and explode mines, robots generally just roving the oceans looking for things out of the ordinary. So, I mean, this is pretty cutting edge technology here, and you do all this yourself, right? This is
yeah.
I mean, I've got the picture up in front of me. I've seen this thing in real life, and the way it interacts with Squeak, and it is so cool. This has to be the coolest Smalltalk project I've ever seen, and I'm sure, like most people, I'm insanely jealous of what you do.
Well. Anybody with any amount of mechanical ability can do this sort of thing, you know, assuming that they can also program computers. I've had to learn a lot to get to the point where I actually built this submarine. I'm not a hardware person at all in terms of electronics. I've never taken any electronics courses or anything like that. I've always just been interested in software. But once again, before I got into computers, I was always building things, so I basically taught myself enough electronics to put it together and make this piece talk to that piece, and off it goes. It's really just a lot of small things that you can put together to make a big thing.
Yeah, I remember one of the small things you showed off was the aspirin test.
yes. Yeah, basically, the idea was I needed a leak detector, and because, you know, these things, eventually you stick stuff in the water and eventually something messes up and it starts leaking. And you know, that's how a lot of submarines end up at the bottom. And of course, you know, having spent a lot of money and a lot of time on this, I didn't want that to happen. So I built a little mechanical switch with a spring that you put an aspirin tablet on. And of course, aspirin, you drop it in a thing of water and it dissolves almost immediately. So the concept was, you have wires attached to each end of the electrodes, and if water gets in the bottom, you put it at the bottom of the sub, and it will dissolve the aspirin, and boom, the two switches contact, the two contacts touch each other, and the computer can tell that and say, oh, I'm leaking, and you know, kick butt back up to the surface if it can, and, you know.
If it hasn't leaked too badly.
Well, that's insanely yeah. simple, though. I mean, I can't believe that something that simple works. I mean, it's just...
Well, as it turns out, it didn't work all that well. it was a cool idea, but the when the aspirin dissolves, it doesn't like disappear. It coats everything with this grimy stuff, which doesn't really conduct electricity all that well. So after doing a little bit more reading, I figured out that you could take two wires and put them right next to each other and put some huge resistance between them with a big, you know, mega ohm resistor. And when water gets in between them, it is a better conductor than that. And they end up, you can read that.
So the water effectively completes the circuit.
Well, that, exactly. That will depend on whether it's salt water or fresh water, right?
No, it actually works in... I mean, it works better in salt water. I've never had this robot in salt water before. It actually works... It works really well in pool water, which is where I did all my testing. Uh-huh. Because there's chlorine and crap like that in the water. But any water that's not, you know, distilled, it should work fine because there's enough suspended particles and minerals and stuff in the water to make it electrically conductive. And, of course, that actually went off once. I was doing a pool test, and I have a little valve on the sub that, because when I push the end caps together, it compresses the air inside, and it tends to want to pop them back off again. So I added a little screw at the bottom with an O-ring so that I could unscrew that, press them together, the air would go out there, and then put the screw back in to seal it back up again. And I forgot to put the screw back in one time. And so I put the sub in. It starts doing its little mission there. And suddenly it breaks the surface and starts going around in the circle and then sinks. Oh. And so I jumped in the pool and you know, tried to get it out off the bottom because it was sitting on the bottom. And pulled it up. And, yeah, it was half full of water. Didn't end up screwing up the computer in it, thankfully. I was running Smalltalk on a PDA at that point. But it did actually work. The whole thing worked. It did exactly what it was supposed to do, which is go up to the surface and start going around in a circle until it gets too much water in it and the buoyancy is too low, and then it just sinks.
You mentioned the PDA. What kind of, what class of hardware do you put on these things?
Well, I've run a bunch of different types of hardware on it over the years. At the very first, I was actually just running a cable back and running the controller on my PC for doing my very first tests. But eventually, I got a... Let me think. It was one of the first PDAs that ran Linux, and Jay Carlson, I think, did a Squeak VM, ported the Squeak VM to it. And so that was the very first one. But eventually I got... That didn't end up working very well. And eventually I got a Dell Axim, which is an X-Scale PDA, running Windows CE.
Right,
and the Japanese guy, Yoshiki. he did the Squeak VM for that a long time ago, so I ran that. And, you know, of course, the great thing about Squeak is it doesn't matter what hardware you're running it on. It's all the same. So I've run it on that. Eventually, I ended up frying my Axum. I plugged in the plug wrong and sent +5 up the ground line and fried it. It's the kind of things that happen when you play with raw hardware. So at that point, I switched to using gum sticks. And that's basically the last thing that I've put in there is a gum stick.
Now I'm not familiar with that at all. What is gum sticks?
A gum stick is a Linux single board computer. It's about the size of a pack of gum. You know, the old style packs of gum.
That's the name.
Yeah, it's about 3/4 inch wide and maybe 3.5 inches long. Little tiny thing, but it's a. The one that I was running in that was a 200 megahertz X scale, and it ran Squeak pretty decently. I've since used other gum sticks on other Smalltalk robotics projects, some of the newer ones, but that was back in sort of 2004 timeframe.
So you don't, I mean, you made the MicroSeeker pick Smalltalk. You don't have to use that anymore?
No, that was actually, I did that back in 98, just after I got started. I realized right away I was going to have to start using microcontrollers because that's how you talk to sensors and motor controllers and servos and things like that. It's much easier to do on microcontrollers, which are basically just like a computer with very little memory and no operating system, and, you know, you're running bare metal kind of thing. You typically program in C or assembler. And back in 98, there wasn't much in the way of cheap or free C compilers available for them, and PIC assembler is, well, it's hideous. Some people like it, but I don't. So anyway, there were commercial C compilers, but they were really expensive. So I said, okay, I'm going to have to write a compiler. So I sat down and thought about it for a while, and I'd been just been using, while I was at Interval Research, I was playing with Squeak. You know, I wrote a web browser for Squeak and a bunch of things. And, of course, Squeak has this neat part of it where the VM is generated, or most of the VM is generated from this pseudo-Smalltalk language called Slang.
Yeah.
It's basically, it's written in Smalltalk, and it actually runs in Smalltalk, but it is written in a very specific manner such that the translator that they have can convert it to C code, and then they just include it with the rest of the C code for the VM and produce the executable. So I decided to do something along those lines, except instead of producing C code, I was going to produce PIC assembler, and then I just wrote a little PIC assembler to convert it to PIC machine code. So it's basically a little compiler that I wrote in Squeak so I could write code that sort of looks like Squeak in Squeak syntax, and generates PIC assembler, and that worked pretty well for the original PIC microcontrollers I was using. Eventually, what I came to realize is as new PICs were coming out, the original ones that I was using, which is a 16F84 for anybody who knows anything about PICs, has very little memory and very little hardware capability. It's got it had 8K of flash and 68 bytes of RAM, which is not a lot.
So I recently saw a guy talking about underwater autonomous vehicles that he makes to map out subterraneous caverns. Basically, they drop the thing into the pure water in the caverns, and it will map out the cavern, fly around, and basically see what's there. They're refitting this thing to send it to, I think it's, is it Europa that's the moon that's covered in ice and water?
I think so. It's one of Saturn or...
Yeah, so they're refitting this thing to also be able to do the sorts of tests that the Mars rovers are doing, except underwater, and they're going to send it to Europa and drop it in there and have it have a long tether back up to the surface so it can transmit back to Earth and basically roam around under Europa, mapping it out and attempting to find life.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool project. And the interesting thing about that project is it's another one of these things where it's driven by just one person. I've never met that person who did that, but I've certainly read about it, and it was really fascinating. This guy's built all kinds of stuff, and that was one of them.
So this is still the kind of field where one or two people can do interesting and valuable things, unlike a lot of software now where you seem to have huge masses of people working on it. You can still do things with small groups of people.
Yeah, well, the thing with robots is, right now, as it stands, nobody knows how to write really good software. You know, and you could say that's true of the entire software field, but it's especially true in the robotics world. It's one of these areas where you have to interact with the real world, and you're basically, for the interesting types of robots, in a completely unconstrained environment. You know, the robot has to operate in the same world that we do, or, you know, even worse places like, you know, underwater. So it turns out that it's a really, really hard thing to do well. And that's one of the reasons why I think Smalltalk is a really good choice for that, because, of course, you can do really hard, complex things in Smalltalk, and if you set it up right, make it relatively easy.
Yeah, you get back to the point that if you're modeling, Smalltalk is easier to model in than, say, C.
Exactly.
Well, I was going to go for a silly segue, because that guy is trying to find life, and here you are with the Microraptor trying to create life that will one day kill us all, is the general theory. This is Skynet in the making. Robots that are, that think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always been my sort of holy grail ever since I started this. And I decided to go into the underwater part of it because I've always been interested in underwater. And it kind of forces you when you start thinking about how it's going to work, it has to be truly autonomous. So you have to really think about how the thing is going to work and how it's going to solve all of these problems by itself, because you can't really communicate very well underwater. You can communicate with some types of audio at very low bandwidth, you know, like 9600 baud, but even that doesn't work very well in all situations. You can't, the radio waves don't work underwater at all. There's no GPS. There's nothing like that. So the robot is truly on its own. And thinking about how to do that is the type of thinking that you have to do in order to build a truly autonomous robot. So getting back to the whole brain thing, you know, when you want to build real artificial intelligence, you know, like the kind C-3PO or the NS5 from iRobot, you know.
I thought you were talking about real artificial intelligence here.
The kind that's portrayed in those movies, you know, where you could carry out a conversation with the robot and potentially be tricked that you're actually talking to a person. You really have to think about it from that level. You know, from how a person works and from how to build something that's truly autonomous that doesn't depend on setting up a constraining environment.
Yeah, I mean, there are different levels of this too, right? Because there's the big dog robotics thing, right? Which is a combat robot that is basically there to follow along with troops and carry very large loads. And its AI has nothing to do with understanding the world around it. It's all about not falling over.
Right. So what they've built with Big Dog and Asimo, you know, the Japanese...
That's the Japanese one, yeah.
...walking robot, the biped, those robots, what they are is they're phenomenal platforms. It's basically the chassis, if you want to think about it, including the software that makes it not fall over and that sort of thing. That's basically the chassis, and one of the there's a lot of hard things in robotics, and one of the hard things is building a chassis that works well, and that's actually one of the reasons why I ended up getting out of underwater robotics eventually, and switching to building land-based robots, because it turns out that it's really hard, and you spend all of your time solving the mechanical problems and not working on the interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you've got a lot of money and can do this sort of thing full time, which I don't.
So that gets into what you're working on now, which is more of the microseeker thing that I was looking at on one of your websites.
The Microraptor.
Okay.
Yeah, Microraptor is a biped robot that I started working on probably 2 years ago. That basically is hopefully eventually going to allow me to start playing with some of my concepts, my AI concepts that I've come up with. I've spent a lot of time over the last 5 years thinking about how to build a brain. And one of the things that I'm convinced of is that in order to do that, the easiest way to do it is to have a robot that is what they call embodied, which means, you know, it has an actual body with limbs and, you know, arms and legs and that sort of thing, and that I can see. So in order to solve the hard AI problem, you really want to have something that works in much the same way that a person or an animal does. You know, a lot of the research is in universities by robots that roll around on treads or wheels, because that basically allows them to ignore the whole balance problem and concentrate on the specific part of AI that they want to do research on. I think that's interesting, but I think in order to get true AI of the kind that I'm thinking of, you know, which we've been trying for 50 years to do that, and nobody has come even remotely close, it's going to require a really revolutionary kind of change, and not just sort of the typical academic evolutionary change where you do this little bit of research and then somebody else takes that and extends it and so on and so forth.
It's interesting, actually, that you bring this up, because various studies and experiments on the mind, on the human mind, have discovered that we build up a mental model of how our own body looks. And then when we interact with something, we expect feedback. And if we don't get feedback, then the brain gets very confused and upset.
Or if the feedback is different than what we expect.
Right. So what they've found is that we can mentally occupy bodies that are wildly different to what we have right now, so long as this loop of do something that you can sense, like see it or feel it, and have that match what you expected. So it's not actually as hardwired as we originally thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an interesting book that I've read. It's called On Intelligence by Jeff Hawkins. He's the guy who invented one of the PDAs there, Palm Pilot and Trio and all that stuff. Anyway, it turns out that was just sort of a little side effort for him. What he's really interested in is artificial intelligence. And his big thesis is that it's all about prediction. Being able to predict what you think is going to happen next. And one of the really funny things that I see him say when he's talking at a conference or something, he says, and everybody who's listening can tell me the word that's at the end of this sentence.
Wonderful. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you're broken. The point. And there are people who are broken, yes.
Yes, but it illustrates the point very well. And if you think about how things work, you can figure out that, yeah, in fact, what we are is big hierarchical sequence engines that do prediction. And that's the basis for my AI system, written in Smalltalk, of course, that I've been working on for a number of years now. And I've kind of run into some difficulties, both in funding and mechanical type issues. So I haven't gotten as far as I'd like to.
I saw a video of a robot that was built from it was a four-legged robot, but it was laid out in a circle, and each leg had probably about 5 joints on it, and the robot wasn't programmed with a knowledge of its own shape. It was programmed with the desire to understand its own shape and then be able to get somewhere. So it had to figure out how to move on its own, and it did that by basically doing feedback. And you would expect from you kind of expect it to figure out how to stand up and walk. But in the end, it actually ended up in series, undulating the legs so that it would sort of roll and rock along the ground. And it never figured out how to move the most efficient way, but it did figure out how to move. And it did end up understanding how it looked at a reasonably superficial level. So that's really promising. But you know what's really interesting is sort of the end game with all this. So say we build robots that do work like us, and they have to learn. And, well, once they've learned, it's all digital. We can copy it. So this is like an evolutionary jumpstart. The process of creating life current for humans takes, you know, a long time to get a mature adult that's really productive. But that would drop it right down.
Yeah, basically, if anybody ever does solve this problem of building an artificial brain that can work at those levels, then there's nothing stopping you. It's just a computer that's running a program, you know, presumably with some kind of big database. So there's nothing stopping you from making a copy of that and sticking it in another chassis or body, or even sticking it just on your personal computer on your desktop.
Well, there are limits, right? I mean, the first computer to simulate the human brain at the size of the human brain is currently under construction at IBM. And it's massive.
Yeah.
To give you an example of how big these things are, the internet with all its connected devices has roughly the same number of network connections as a single human brain. Right. So yeah, our brains run really slowly, but they are massively parallelized.
Exactly. They're massively parallelized and complex. I don't believe that we need to build an artificial brain that works the same physical way that our brain does. I believe that we can take something and basically, I don't want to say fake it, but model it and simulate it.
Yeah, imitate it.
Yeah, basically, at a much simpler in one way, but at a much higher level in another, where you can have abstract concepts represented in a reasonable way. Now, I have no idea whether or not that'll ever work.
Well, no, I think it'll work. I mean, there was a really cool study on a colony of robots that they made. And the robots could go out into the field of play. And out there were two types of things, food and death. when the robots could observe another robot taking food or death, and tell the other robots. So they ran this experiment with four different fields, and three out of the fields successfully created a colony of robots that would communicate and guide their fellow robots to the food. The fourth colony produced something wholly interesting. Some of the robots would lie to their fellow robots and send them to death so that they would get more food. Things like that. It's just... there was another experiment that demonstrated the tendency for natural things to go towards more complex. A giant robot that is made up of squares, and the squares can roll and turn. And if they connect up to another square, they stay connected until they decide to disconnect. Well, there are six sides to the square, so the natural tendency was that all these squares would eventually just clump together into a more complex system. So they ran that without any kind of reward system at all. And without any reward system, yes, all the squares ended up mostly clumped together.
Yeah, there's been some really interesting research done in the field of, I think they're called adaptable robots or configurable or whatever, basically a bunch of squares that can fit together in different mechanisms and form snakes or, you know, things that can walk on two legs or four legs. I've even seen one where it puts itself into a loop and can roll, which is really cool to see. I mean, I don't think it does that itself. I think the behavior is programmed in this particular case. Yes, it is. But it's more proving the mechanical concept that, you know, these types of robots are capable of a lot of different forms of locomotion.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. The best way to make changes to a system is to make them incrementally. You want to keep the system running at each stage and make only small changes at a time. What do you do then when you need to change a whole component of the infrastructure? If you replace that component, all the code that uses that component would need to be changed as well. As a result, you could end up breaking large portions of the system for long periods of time. The best thing to do in that case may be to write a replacement for that infrastructure component that can coexist with the old one. In this way, you can get new code to use the new component and, over time, migrate old code which uses the old component to use the new component instead. If you're successful, you'll eventually be able to remove the old component. This approach is much more likely to succeed than just making the change all at once. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
In this segment, we have James Savage with the week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. In what may be fitting for Christmas time in the Northern Hemisphere, the two new jobs this week are in snowy Minnesota. Minneapolis, Minnesota. ATR International Inc. has a one-plus-year contract for a Smalltalk developer who also has experience with JBoss and Java. Minneapolis, Minnesota. There are multiple positions available for an 11-month contract, and at least 18 different companies are advertising the positions, so I won't be listing them all here. They are looking for experience with Object Studio, VisualWorks, Web Services, SQL Server, Performance Optimization, Java, and the people should have excellent communication skills. Experience that is considered a plus includes credit card processing, JConnect, banking or retail experience, and Sybase Open Client. David Lewis at Strategic Staffing, DA Lewis at strategicstaff.com, called me to talk to me about the position. He sent me an email with additional details about the position, including the following. Quote, spoke with the manager and she is upgrading from 7.2 to 8.2. This is a service app that spans the credit card systems in Wells Fargo. They are moving from Object Studio to VisualWorks. Other information that I have indicates that the contracts will start in the beginning of February. The jobs listed in this report are just a few examples of these Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs, or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and I wish you good luck with your job hunting.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretation podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.